As fiscal pressures start mounting in the state, there are some, and it's happened in the past, who the first place they're going to go is to the permanent fund dividend.
Democratic lawmakers work to protect the permanent fund dividend in the Constitution. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Keegan Randall is being called a gold medal favorite for Sochi. Can she live up to the hype?
She's kind of like the Usain Bolt of this event. She's had a pretty dominant run competing in this event.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Senator Mark Begich says the U.S. Postal Service has agreed to roll back its parcel post rate hike for shipments to rural Alaska. In a Senate committee hearing today, he added an amendment to a postal reform bill to undo the increase imposed last week for in-state mail to communities not linked by road. But he says he secured a separate commitment from the Postmaster General to lower rates immediately or as soon as the post office can change its machines. Begich said at the hearing today, the increase had unintended consequences for Alaska.
This was a national decision to make sure that if there's competition, you'd have a different kind of rate structure. In rural Alaska, the Postal Service is dominant. They are a monopoly.
Rural Alaskans rely on parcel posts to receive all kinds of goods and merchandise. Begich says Alaskans have been complaining to him that new rates had them paying as much as 50% more for delivery. Deputy Postmaster General Ron Stroman says the Postal Service gets it.
Senator Begich, we understand that in Alaska, the effect of these price increases could potentially have a disproportionate impact because of the lack of roads, for example.
For large freight deliveries, rural Alaskans benefit from bypass mail, an Alaska-only subsidy that costs the Postal Service more than $70 million a year. Nothing in the postal reform bill that cleared the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee today would change that program. Still, Begich is claiming credit for saving it. Begich told reporters he's been able to persuade budget hawks like Republican Senators Tom Coburn and John McCain, who 2 years ago tried to kill it.
They knew if there was any attempt to strip away bypass mail or diminish it, that I would cause havoc to this bill and make sure this bill never gets out of committee.
A spokesman for Senator John McCain says the Arizona senator still doesn't support bypass mail. Begich warns the program may face stiff opposition in the House. Governor Sean Parnell says the state is not to blame for Flint Hills' decision to close its North Pole refinery. The company says costs related to the cleanup of sulfalane groundwater contamination from historic spills of the industrial solvent at the refinery were a factor that went into the decision to stop production. The state recently set a strict sulfalane contamination threshold for groundwater cleanup. But speaking to reporters yesterday, Governor Parnell downplayed the significance of state regulation in the refinery shutdown.
They didn't come to us and say, if you'll do this, we won't close down. I mean, they made a business decision, and we're having to live with the consequences.
The shutdown of the refinery will take away a ready source of heat for crude oil shipped down the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Portions of oil unused by Flint Hills to produce fuel are returned to the main line. An Alaska Pipeline Service Company spokeswoman Michelle Egan says the heat added at the refinery has become increasingly important to ensure oil keeps flowing during the winter.
Especially as we get into lower throughput and temperature of the crude oil, we need to keep that high enough to keep it flowing. So we've really benefited from that over the years.
Egan says Alyeska pays Flint Hills for the heat and will spend the money on alternative methods to keep crude flowing safely.
The good news for TAPS is that we have a lot of other alternatives for heat. So we currently do recirculation of crude oil at Pump Station 9 and Pump Station 7. And so we have enough heat that it shouldn't impact us operationally. But it was, of course, another source for us.
Egan says adjustments to pipeline interface infrastructure at North Pole may be required when the Flint Hills refinery stops taking crude oil. A group of Democratic lawmakers is pushing an amendment that would enshrine the permanent fund dividend in the state constitution, APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
Representative Les Guerra of Anchorage is carrying the legislation for his caucus, and he presented it to the House State Affairs Committee on Thursday. He says because the state is looking at budget deficits for the foreseeable future, it's important to lock in the dividend as a right.
As fiscal pressures start mounting in the state, there are some, and it's happened in the past, who the first place they're going to go is to the permanent fund dividend.
Guerra also frames it as an issue of income equality.
We've had the least differential growth between rich and poor in the state of any other state in the country because of the permanent fund dividend.
While all but one member of the House's Democratic minority has signed off on the amendment, members of the Republican majority are a little cool on it. Representative Alan Osterman of Kodiak says that while he's willing to entertain the amendment, he believes it could end up putting the legislature in a difficult financial position.
The permanent fund and the dividend program itself were to look at future needs of the state of Alaska. Not necessarily the future needs of each individual, but the future of the state.
House Speaker Mike Chenault says if the legislature were prohibited from tapping the permanent fund, they would just have to find other ways to collect revenue should the state run out of savings.
When we talk about that type of long-term planning, it means one thing, taxes.
Chenault says the most likely forms would be an income tax or state sales tax. As of this year, the state has about $17 billion in savings. The Alaska Permanent Fund is valued at nearly $50 billion. The amendment needs approval from two-thirds of the legislature to advance, and minority Democrats make up just one quarter of the body. If it passes, it would then go on the ballot for voters to decide. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Goodwill Industries opened a job center in downtown Anchorage today. The nonprofit center aims to help those with barriers to employment overcome them. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
At the corner of C and 6th Street in downtown Anchorage, Lauren Stewart points to a big white board on the wall near a row of computers.
What we are looking at is our hot jobs board. This is where we will daily post the most recent and hopefully relevant jobs for our clients walking through the door.
Stewart runs the new Job Connection Center for Goodwill Industries. Besides the hot jobs board, she says there's all kinds of equipment to help job seekers.
We have 6 computers that are all connected to our main network with all of the websites from Workforce Alaska to the municipality of Anchorage will be uploaded and easy to access. We have fax machine, copier, printer, telephone, and most importantly, we have employment specialists and job coaches to help people really define what they need, what they want, and how to get it.
Most people have heard of Goodwill thrift stores. The thrift stores are used for on-the-job training, and the money they make supports the job centers, like the one going in downtown. Jim Martin is president of Goodwill Industries, based in Eugene, Oregon. He says the job center is just the beginning for Anchorage, and a thrift store is in the works.
We think an opportunity to put a thrift store on the ground would be beneficial for not only individuals that are looking for a good deal on clothing and household items, but it's also a great place to train individuals and provide them with initial skills to get them into the workforce.
Martin says he's not sure where the thrift store will be yet, but he's hoping it will go in soon.
There's many areas that are flourishing in retail, and we want to be in one of those areas. So we're still looking, and we're optimistic that we'll have a store here in the next year or two.
The center will also help clients find appropriate clothing for interviews if needed. The job center is the first for Goodwill in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the violence in South Sudan hits close to home for a resident of Unalaska.
When I heard that, you know, I was, you know, devastated. You know, I didn't know what to do, either to go there, I'm not going to do anything.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Sea Life Center will host the 5th annual Alaska Marine Gala on Saturday, February 15th at the Denina Center in Anchorage. The evening will include live and silent auctions. dinner, dancing, and a presentation by UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Dean, Dr. Mike Castellini. More information about sponsorship and tickets for this event can be found at alaskasealife.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Sea Life Center.
An NBC affiliate says it has reached an agreement with Alaska's largest telecommunications company that will return its programming to rural communities just in time for the Winter Olympics. Anchorage station KTUU says its rural programming was resuming today after it reached a multi-year contract with General Communications Incorporated. GCI dropped KTUU from its rural broadcasts in November following a breakdown in contract negotiations. KTUU announced the contract agreement in a statement today. It says KTUU and GCI had earlier agreed on rates but disagreed on final contract language. KTUU was among companies that unsuccessfully challenged GCI's purchase of three television stations in Anchorage, Juneau, and Sitka. The Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, began today with qualifying rounds in some sports. Six athletes competing in the games call Alaska home or have roots in the state. The most talked about are the cross-country skiers from Alaska Pacific University, Keegan Randall, Holly Brooks, Sadie Bjornson, and her brother Eric. Anchorage Daily News reporter Nathaniel Herz is in Sochi covering the games for ADN and for FasterSkier.com. He says Randall absolutely has a shot at a gold medal in Sochi.
She's kind of like the Usain Bolt of this event in the sport. She's had a pretty dominant run competing in this event. I think up until last weekend, she had been on the podium in every skate sprint she'd entered kind of at the international level for about the last 2 years. There's one other woman, she's Norwegian, her name is Marit Bjørgen, and she's kind of this bionic woman. She is sort of almost unbeatable. She's won several dozen World Cup races and several gold medals at the last Olympics, and she's kind of Keegan's biggest competition. But it's really sort of expected to be almost like a showdown between those two. There are plenty of other women that are strong and that could be in there, but those are the two favorites for sure.
Keegan was fifth in the World Cup skate sprint in Italy last weekend. How much do you think those results matter?
I don't think they matter all that much. I mean, certainly it's probably nicer to come into the Olympics having won the event beforehand. Although there are a lot of people who kind of say if you win the event beforehand, it's a little bit like a curse and you actually don't want to do that. You want to be like second, third, fourth. If you actually watch the race, it's not like she ended up way back of the pack. She was actually leading most of the race. And then at the end, everyone kind of came around her at the finish in the home stretch and kind of nipped her. And, you know, it was not like she was far less strong than these women. It seemed like it came down to a more tactical issue. And the course that they were competing on was definitely sort of a more tactical course than the one at the Olympics, which is, you know, has some pretty steep hills and challenging sections. So I think it's expected to be sort of less technical and more about fitness and power, which, you know, Keegan does not have in short supply.
What are the other big cross-country skiing events Alaskans should pay attention to in Sochi?
Well, the Alaskan women that are competing in the Olympics, Holly Brooks and Sadie Bjornson, between those two and Keegan Randall, they're likely to make up at least half, if not three quarters, of the women's relay team. That event, it's four women, and they each race 5 kilometers tagging off to each other. That event comes later in the games, and they have a pretty good shot at a medal in that event. And then there's also the team sprint, where Keegan will almost certainly be one of the two team members in that race, and then she could be teamed with Sadie or maybe another woman. And that's an event where actually they won a gold medal at the World Championships last year, Keegan and this woman, Jessie Diggins from Minnesota. Although that was when they were competing in that last year, it was in a different technique, freestyle versus classical. So that might be a little tougher for them at the Olympics, but I think they'll still be in there.
How big a deal are the Olympic Games for the sport of cross-country skiing?
It's huge. You know, I think this year the team and the athletes have an opportunity unlike any they've had in the last 4 decades, where they're going in with some really, really serious chances at an Olympic medal. And, you know, you do that and it just, you know, it gets the athletes in the sport that much more exposure and presumably gets that many more people excited about it. And, you know, sort of is a can be a pretty big deal for growing the sport if you have success at this big of an event. So, yeah, I think there's sort of a lot of anticipation on the part of people who are involved in the sport this time around.
Nathaniel Herz is covering the Sochi Olympics for FasterSkier.com and the Anchorage Daily News. He'll be giving us regular updates on all the cross-country skiing action. Besides the cross-country skiers to watch from Alaska, Ryan Stassel from Anchorage is competing in the Olympic slope-style snowboard competition, and curler Jessica Schultz was born in Anchorage. Biathlon competitor Sarah Studebaker is from Idaho, but sometimes trains in Anchorage. The annual Alaska Forum on the Environment is underway at the Dena'ina Convention Center in Anchorage. Yesterday, federal project managers gave updates on cleanup projects across the state within national parks, on federal aviation property, and at defense sites. The Defense Department has 537 formerly used defense sites, or FUDs. Of those, 70 remain active for cleanup. Ken Andrashko is the Alaska Region Army Corps of Engineers Chief of the FUDS program here. He says two sites in Alaska are currently getting the most funding, the Northeast Cape on St. Lawrence Island and the Umiat area near the Colville River in the National Petroleum Reserve. He says this year's ongoing PCB cleanup on Test Well 9 at Umiat is getting underway.
So right now they're getting the camp set up, and I think this week they actually start digging. So they'll be digging out the PCB contaminated soil at Umiat.
The Corps' contractors can only work on the tundra for 2 or 3 months during the winter season. Andrashko says the Navy used PCBs in drilling muds in the 1940s to learn more about where the oil was.
They wanted to see if they would work as a tracer for finding oil during the exploration back in the 40s.
Andrashko says he's hopeful Test Well 9 will be completed during this season. He says another trouble spot is the old Umiat Air Force Station landfill along the Colville River. He says old fuel drums are a large part of the problem, but high water also scrubs out other troubling debris.
Our guess is there's tens and tens of thousands of old drum carcasses. We believe there might be the actual drilling equipment that was used, a lot of heavy iron and old building debris, but certainly there could be a battery because one has popped out in the past and a transformer has popped out in the past before.
Old transformers contain PCBs. Andrashko says cleanup at Northeast Cape on St. Lawrence Island is going well.
The PCBs that have been out there, we finally got all those finished up last year. The majority of the petroleum is out. I think we got at least one more good year this year to do the very active remediation with the big excavators taking out dirt. And then we're going to install a whole slew of monitoring wells to kind of monitor how well the remediation's been going.
Andrashko says federal funding has been steady despite cutbacks in some areas. He says Congress boosted funds nationally for FUDs cleanup last year by $50 million. Bill Huebner with the National Park Service says most sites within national parks are smaller fuel contamination cleanups. He says they have problems with bears pulling the covers off monitoring wells and flinging them around like frisbees and occasionally tipping tanks over. The FAA also deals with fuel cleanup at airports across the state and some PCB problems from old transformers.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
A Bethel jury has ordered the city of Hooper Bay to pay close to $1 million to the family of a man that died at the Hooper Bay jail. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The jury found that the city of Hooper Bay was negligent in the death of 22-year-old Lewis Bunyan. Judge Charles Ray read the next portion of the jury's verdict.
Was the defendant, city of Hooper Bay's negligence a substantial factor in causing harm to the plaintiffs? Answer yes or no. Answer yes.
The judge then polled the jury individually after the verdict and found 11 in agreement and one juror who was not. The jury said that Bunyan was contributing to his family at the time of his death, and they awarded some $960,000 to family members. Lewis Bunyan was found dead in his jail cell early on the morning of July 28, 2011. He was brought into the jail only 40 minutes before he was found hanged by the drawstring from his shorts. Bunyan was first taken to jail after a report that he was intoxicated at his home and trying to fight with his family. The family requested that police take him into Title 47 protective custody while intoxicated. The events early that morning in holding cell number one led Bunyan's mother, Judy Bunyan, to file a lawsuit against the city of Hooper Bay seeking damages. Her attorney charged that the city has a duty to screen detainees for the potential risk of suicide, ensure they have no items to harm themselves, and to regularly monitor their condition. They say police had a database listing three prior calls in which Bunyan had threatened suicide. Interviews with the police officers in the jail that night revealed they were using Facebook and online poker. The plaintiffs charged that the officers did not check on Mr. Bunyan at regular intervals. The cell had no lights and had a mesh screen that allowed a string to be fastened. Bunyan then used that string to hang himself. The city of Hooper Bay's attorney in a trial brief argued that police qualify for immunity and that Title 47 care also immunized the police. The attorney says they would only owe a duty of care to prevent suicide if they were on reasonable notice that Bunyan was a suicide risk. They say neither police nor family members indicated that Bunyan was at risk for suicide. The city's attorney tells the Alaska Dispatch that they plan to appeal. For KYUK, I'm Ben Matheson.
A civil war being fought on the other side of the world has hit home for one Unalaska resident. Mayak Bilquay is from South Sudan, where ethnic and political violence have claimed up to 10,000 lives, including some of his own family. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports.
It's a cold and snowy winter day in Unalaska. Mayak Bilquay is bundled up in a windbreaker over a thick sweatshirt and extra tough boots, practically the uniform at this fish processing plant.
Yeah, this is where we work inside this building. The one straight ahead. Yeah, it's big buildings.
Bilquay has worked for UNICEF for a decade, but every winter he takes off to see his family. Bilquay's wife and son live in Nairobi, Kenya, and he usually goes to visit them. This year, Bilquay wanted to go to South Sudan, but the political situation there was tense. The president and vice president were fighting, and soldiers in the National Army were taking sides. So Bilquay flew to Kenya and waited for things to calm down.
You know, eventually the war broke out in the capital of South Sudan, Juba. So at that point, I couldn't make it to go to South Sudan.
Bilquay watched as the conflict spread like wildfire. Rebels broke off from the military and fought against it. Some residents took up arms and formed militias. Old tribal conflicts that had quieted down after South Sudan became an independent country just 2 years ago flared back up again. In late December, the fighting reached Ponriang, the remote county where Bilquay's family lives. It was a quiet time in their village.
The young guys, they were not around because it was a farming area. Nobody stayed there except the elder women.
Bilquay says a militia from an opposing tribe, the Nuer, has come to the village before to steal food and cattle. He believes the same group came back, this time to fight.
So when they came in, you know, they start shooting people. So they kill. At that time, you know, they kill my mom and her twin sister and the other two sisters, four of them.
Another relative traveled up to the village to identify the bodies and those of eight other family members. He called Bilquay in Kenya, where he was still on vacation, to break the news.
When I heard that, you know, I was, you know, devastated. You know, I didn't know what to do, either to go there, I'm not going to do anything. So I just called people, and then we went to the church, and then we pray. That was the only thing that I did, is just to go to church and pray.
Bilquay is back in Unalaska now, processing fish for UNICEF. He still works 12-hour days and comes home to a company apartment just like before. He hasn't heard from his surviving family, the men who were out of the village off at a cattle camp when the militia came.
They have run far away. Nobody now in his own place, in his own house. They all ran to the bush.
The United Nations says a total of 700,000 people have fled their homes because of this war. The UN and other aid groups are trying to do something about it. They pressured the rebels who broke away from the military to sign a ceasefire with the central government, but it hasn't lasted. They kept struggling for power, and the fighting started right back up again. Belkwe says it's not fair to civilians.
Those people who were killed, including my mom, has never, you know, he doesn't even know that government is functioning, is working. He just knows that he's living on the farming area. That's all she knows. And that there is God. But she doesn't know that there is a government.
The farming area in Panriang is near South Sudan's oil fields. The people who live there put up with pollution and occasional violence from factions that want to control the oil. They don't see any of the money from it. But that land is still home. The last time Belkwe's mother left the village, the last time he saw her, was about 5 years ago.
I brought my mother to Nairobi one time when my wife was going to deliver. You know, I called her to come and take care of her because I was not there. So she came to Nairobi and she stayed there for about 6 months. So, and then I left from here. I went there and then she said, oh, now I have to go back home.
When I ask him what he's going to do, to try to find his surviving relatives or get them out of South Sudan, Belkwe politely brushes the question aside.
You know, now this is not a problem of my family right now. You know, this is a problem for everybody. The people that are being slaughtered and, you know, they don't know anything about it, you know, it's really very painful. There's nothing I can help now, but, you know, we need to speak out, you know, to international community, to anybody that could, you know, help. Is to just keep the information of this place out, place called Panriang.
That's why Belkwe is planning to travel there later this year. He wants to talk to people in the county and in his family's village about what happened, take pictures, gather facts about the war, and then he wants to bring their stories home. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Lauren Rosenthal in Onalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Doyon Limited, announcing the 2014 Board of Directors election beginning January 22nd. Early bid proxy submission needed by Friday, February 14th. Information at doyon.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.gov. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.